From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Tom Bullock in for Mike Collins. The killing of Keith Lamont Scott by CMPD officer Brentley Vinson last September sparked nights of protest, sometimes violent, and dozens of arrests. Scott's family says he was unarmed, carrying only a book. CMPD says he was carrying a gun. An internal investigation by CMPD released in April found Vinson acted lawfully. The district attorney agreed and filed no criminal charges. But now, Charlotte's Citizen Review Board says they have some questions about the case. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn has been following this story, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the Citizens Review Board adjudicates complaints between civilians and the CMPD. Gwen, what did they find last night?
Well, Tom, after about 5 hours behind closed doors, they decided by a vote of 8-2 that there was substantial evidence that the in saying that Vinson acted lawfully and was justified in shooting Scott, that there was evidence to show that there was an error in terms of CMPD in making that decision. So let's hear what the attorney, Julian Wright, he's the attorney for the Citizens Review Board, and he spoke for the board after the hearing was over.
What the CRB determined this evening was that there is substantial evidence of error that the police department's determination that the shooting was justified is correct. So what's going to happen next is there's going to be an evidentiary fact-finding hearing where the Citizens Review Board will get more information, will hear directly from officers and other witnesses, be able to get the benefit of examination and cross-examination by lawyers of the various witnesses, and then be able, hopefully, to make an ultimate determination in August as to whether a preponderance of the evidence shows that there was a clear error in the determination that the shooting was justified.
Now, Tom, during that hearing, Wright says that you're going to have examinations, cross-examinations. It's going to be like almost like a trial. He says it's probably going to take all day. They're also talking about introducing exhibits and showing videos from the shooting, some maybe that was actually recorded by Scott's wife and also those that CMPD has.
Now, so we know obviously about this meeting that will happen in August, the trial that you were just describing. Do we know why the board specifically found what they say substantial evidence of error?
Well, after the meeting, again, it was a closed door hearing, and Wright was not able to give us any information. He said that that's all confidential, that what happens in the hearing is confidential, and that he was not able to discuss what kind of things that they found that made them say there was substantial error. So we don't know what the concerns were, and we won't know when this hearing happens because it will also be a closed hearing as well unless they talk about it afterwards.
Hmm. Now, the Citizens Review Board, you know, they've never found, at least as far as we've been able to find, in favor of a citizen in cases of a CMPD officer involved shooting. What has the reaction been to this finding last night?
Well, I have not talked to the family, but again, only thing we had last night, and the hearing again went very late, was from the attorney. So I'm not sure how the family is reacting to this. I'm sure they will see this as a positive. I did talk with Corinne Mack, who is president of the local NAACP, and she said she was very happy by the decision. It was an 8-2 again. She said she wished it was unanimous, but that she would take that 8-2 vote and that she is optimistic because she says they have never gotten this far in a case involving CMPD and in terms of something like this. And she did also say that she hopes that they would change their mind, even though the regulations allow them to hold these meetings in closed door, because they said a lot of confidential information might be discussed, it's personnel issues, those kinds of things. She said that she wished they would make them open and transparent, especially if the police department wants to have a better relationship with the Charlotte community. So she says that she thinks all those types of hearings should be open, especially when it involves a police officer and a police officer fatal shooting.
Now, if the CRB does rule against Officer Brentley Vinson, what's at stake for him? What could happen?
Well, the board does not have a power. They can make a recommendation. And what they're going to do is they're going to make their recommendation to Police Chief Putney. He can go along with the recommendation and reverse the order if they come to that decision. They might decide that nothing needs to be done and that the police department's decision was the accurate one. But if they decide that this is a decision that the police department should be reversed, they will make that recommendation. If the chief decides he doesn't want to go along with that decision, they can then send the recommendation to the city manager, who can make his own decision at that point. And the attorney Wright said that what disciplinary action, if either of those two steps, you know, goes along with the recommendation, if it comes to that, that, you know, they have no, he has no idea what that would be.
A lot to catch up on there. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn. Gwen, thanks for the update.
My pleasure.
Now we move to a national trend that's going very, very local. Next week, the race for Charlotte mayor officially kicks off when candidates begin filing the paperwork launching their campaigns. But already, at least two dark money groups have formed, hoping to influence the outcome of that race. Now, officially, these groups are known as 501c4 organizations, social welfare groups that are supposed to, quote, further the common good and general welfare of the community. And some do just that. But since the 2010 Citizens United case, the number of 501c4s with a political bent has been growing because they can raise unlimited amounts of money and keep their donor lists secret. One of these groups, Queen City Leadership, supports Democrat Jewel Ford. They did not respond to our invitation to come on this program, but the Republican group, Forward Charlotte, did. Mark Knoop is their executive director. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me on today.
Now, by law, you are allowed to keep your donor list private. And, you know, we were talking before the show, and you're not, I know you're not about to tell us who your donors are today. So instead, I'll ask this. Why is it important for these donors to be secret?
Well, there are different reasons for that. I think one thing that 501c4s are good for, though, is keeping donors private, because it shields donors from retaliation or reprisal. And that happens a lot in municipal elections when you show up on a finance report. But it also, you know, gives them an opportunity to be a part of the solution to the issues that they see in Charlotte right now. And that's what our group is focused on. It gives them an opportunity to exercise their First Amendment rights to engage in the political process without fear of reprisal.
Now, you keep saying reprisal. Reprisal by whom?
City leadership.
Like a vendetta? You supported the person I beat in the campaign, so I'm not going to, you know, support your project?
Sure.
Okay. You're not going to tell us who the donors is. Again, perfectly legal. That's the way it works on both sides. But can you tell me the average donation, number of donors, any kind of information like that?
I can't, no.
Okay. What is the goal of Forward Charlotte?
So Forward Charlotte is an organization dedicated to bringing together citizens in Charlotte to come together and right the ship, so to speak. We want to provide a vision for Charlotte's future and restore our city's identity. Forward Charlotte is going to provide a voice for the business community to make Charlotte a better place to start a business, to grow a business, and a better place to raise a family.
So is it mostly business donors then, or that's your focus?
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to bring in our second guest to the panel right now. Larry Noble is Senior Director, Ethics and General Counsel at the Campaign Legal Center, and he is an outspoken critic of 501c4s in this particular in elections. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So what do you see with the problems of 501c4s keeping their donor lists secret?
Well, I think it's a major problem. You know, we all talk about Citizens United, how the Supreme Court said that corporations and individuals can make unlimited independent expenditures, and how this gave rise to the C4s using undisclosed money to influence elections. But what people forget was that in Citizens United, the Supreme Court said that one of the reasons it wasn't concerned about these type of expenditures is that they would be fully disclosed and that we would know where the money was coming from. It said that in this day with the internet and the ability to get information out there, that it was assured that the public would understand where the money was coming from, would be able to make decisions on the messages they were received, in part based on the source of that information. So this is really undermining the very basic concept that even this Supreme Court, which I disagreed with in Citizens United, but even this Supreme Court based its decision on. And I also find it interesting that Justice Scalia, who was opposed to most campaign finance regulation, said that requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. So even Justice Scalia thought that if you're going to do these political expenditures, you should be willing to disclose who you are and stand up for it. So I think it really undermines our whole campaign finance system and, frankly, undermines one of the basis of our democracy, that people are informed about where influence is coming from.
Sure. So you don't, you definitely don't agree with the reprisal argument. You agree in this case with the former Justice Antonin Scalia, who said it's time to stand up and be counted.
Yes. And look, I'm not going to say there is not a danger of reprisals. And the Supreme Court in Buckley dealt with that issue. In Buckley versus Valeo, one of the arguments against disclosure was that people could be harassed. And the court said if there was real evidence of the potential for harassment, and they're not just talking about that you're that people don't like you because of your political stance, but they're talking about.
I think we're losing Larry there. Larry is joining us via Skype. We'll do our best to get that connection back up. Larry, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Now we can hear you. Please continue your thoughts.
I was saying that in Buckley, the Supreme Court said that dealt with this very issue and said that that if you can show a real history of harassment, a real danger of harassment, then you might not have to disclose. But this idea just that we don't want to be unpopular is not sufficient to undo disclosure. I'm not going to say that there aren't groups out there that don't really face real dangers of reprisal, but it's being used as just a cover for everything now to just hide from the public where this money is coming from. You know, one thing I would note, and I thought it was interesting that your guest said that he wouldn't even say what the average contribution is. We don't know if this money is coming from one or two people. We don't know if it's coming from individuals, corporations, or foreign nationals. We have no way of knowing this unless there's disclosure.
That's an interesting point. Love them or hate them, and we'll get back to that here in a second, but love them or hate them. Again, these groups, completely legal, and they are operating on both sides. And dark money groups have largely played a role at the top of the ticket races, things like president, senator, U.S. House of Representatives. But having them involved in a mayor's race is new here in Charlotte, but it is becoming common. Larry, how often have we seen them at this kind of local level?
You're right. It's becoming more common. Initially, we only saw these at the federal level, and we saw a lot of money being spent at the federal level. But this follows a pattern we've seen with campaign finance law loopholes in the past, where it starts making its way down to state and then local elections, council races. And some people think that it's actually more efficient to try to put some of this money into local races because you can have a lot bigger impact with less money. So $1 million in a mayoral race is a lot of money. In a senatorial race, it's not as much money. It's still a lot of money, but it's not as much. So we're seeing this more and more, and we're seeing outside groups, outside interests going into cities, going into counties, going into states, trying to influence policy, influence who's being elected by using these dark money groups. And I think, again, the public, if that's fine. The Supreme Court has said they can do that, as long as they don't do it in coordination with candidates. But the public has a right to know who's doing it.
All right, we're talking campaign finance and dark money groups in the Charlotte mayor's race, not just for U.S. Senator or president anymore. We'll continue our conversation with Mark Knoop and Larry Noble after this break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles new and used. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord at the Hendrick Auto Mall, Concord Mills, or HendrickVWofConcord.com. And from America's biopharmaceutical companies, every day 140,000 researchers across the country, including thousands in North Carolina, search for tomorrow's breakthrough cures. More information at GoBoldly.com. Well, tomorrow marks 10 years since the Apple iPhone arrived on store shelves and in users' hands. A decade ago, we couldn't have imagined how it would change the world and us. When Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone in 2007, smartphones weren't yet ubiquitous. Only 10% of the U.S. population owned one. Now 80% do. Today, our lives are now compressed into our phones. We'll discuss how this one device has changed the world, how we communicate, our relationship with technology, and with each other when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, what's in your credit score? Millions will get a bump next month. We'll look at why. And we'll look at Google's antitrust troubles in Europe. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock, and we're talking campaign finance and the sudden appearance of dark money groups as we prepare for Charlotte's mayoral race. We're joined with Mark Knoop, who runs a 501c4, a Republican group that is one of these, as they are called, dark money groups, and Larry Noble, who is an outspoken critic of the use of 501c4s to influence elections. I want to open this up. I know we've been talking one-on-one, but I'd like to have both of you think about this question. And it goes, I think, Larry, to something you were alluding to earlier. There are campaign finance limits in every state and federal race. An individual can only give a set amount of money per campaign, per race. So here in North Carolina, that's $5,200. So as an individual, I am capped to give $5,200 to a particular candidate per each race. But with PACs, political action committees, and these 501c4s, you can take unlimited amounts of money from individuals and spend it how you like. Does this destroy the idea of campaign finance limits? Mark, I know you've been a Republican strategist for a long time here. I'd like to hear what you think first.
Well, I mean, my personal opinion is that I think campaign contribution limits violate your First Amendment right to free speech and political expression. But I mean, I'm not going to defend the system or any other 501c4 group except for Charlotte, which I run. I mean, Larry might be the expert on that question.
Sure, Larry.
Well, you know, in the theory behind the lack of limits for the C4s and the super PACs is that they don't coordinate with the candidate. And therefore, the Supreme Court has said that an ad taken out by one of these groups could hurt the candidate as well as help the candidate because they don't coordinate. And also, there's less of a danger of a quid pro quo, that the candidate will feel beholden because of this total lack of coordination and this total independence of these groups. The reality is these groups really aren't independent in any practical sense. These groups are often set up by people who've worked with the candidate, talk with the candidate, candidates fundraise for these groups. So there's no real sense that they are in fact independent. So what you have is, yes, a way to get around the contribution limits. The candidate is grateful, is much more grateful for a $100,000 contribution to the C4 organization that is supporting him or her than he is to somebody who gives $1,000 directly to his campaign. So they have really become appendages of the campaign, or some call them shadow campaigns. And so I think they are definitely a way around the contribution limits.
Mark.
Well, and I will clarify too about Forward Charlotte. We are a 501c4, and we are not directly connected to a political campaign. And a majority of our work is going to be issue advocacy, providing voice for the business community, and bringing forth dialogue in the upcoming elections and also next year and the year after that on issues we feel important. I can't say that we are connected to a campaign because we are not. We're also not just focusing on holding the mayor of Charlotte accountable. I think it's important to recognize that in a weak mayor system, especially in Charlotte, the mayor has a position of influence rather than a position of direct power. I think in the last year and a half, we've seen that position of influence can actually be used maybe in a not so good way with unfavorable results. But we also have to hold city leadership accountable, the people who actually have votes on city council.
Now, you say you're not directly involved or affiliated with a particular candidate, but you are a Republican strategist, have been for a long time. There is but one Republican in the mayoral race. So I think it is fair to say that we know your preferred candidate so far. There is a clause or kind of an oddity in North Carolina campaign finance law, which does allow outside groups to coordinate with campaigns during specific windows of an election. That, again, also, love it or hate it, is perfectly legal in North Carolina. Have you had a chance to do any of that, or would you do any of that with the one Republican candidate for mayor, Kenny Smith?
Absolutely not. We're staying completely independent and nonpartisan. So we are not going to coordinate with any campaigns, and we take the legal aspect of this very seriously. And, a dark money group is a very pejorative term that people use usually to try and silence their critics and so forth. But we're not hiding what our mission is here. We're not going to hide what our plans are. We're being as open as we can be about it.
And, again, dark money groups, you can see it as a pejorative or not. They are also on both sides, Democrats and Republicans. Again, we invited the Democratic version of this, a Democratic group that supports Joel Ford on the program today. They did not respond. Again, thank you. You did. But my question to both of you, and Larry, let's start with you, is this just the new normal, outside money, unlimited contributions at such a granular level as Charlotte Mayor?
Unless something is done about it, yes, it is the new normal. We can expect more and more money to be spent this way. And I don't know whether Mark's group, whether it talks with the candidate, what it does. But these are groups are very effective because, in part, they hide who their donors are. And we're going to see more and more of this. We have in this country some very wealthy individuals who have just decided that they and they're open about it, that they want to influence elections where they can. And this is one of the ways they can do it. So, yes, it is the new normal. Now, what may happen is people may get outraged enough by it. They may get concerned enough by it that we'll see some real reform efforts, at least in the disclosure area where the Supreme Court has said you can have reform. And, my basic question is, why not just tell us who's behind these groups and the public can decide whether your message is valid or not?
Mark.
Well, right now we are operating in the landscape that we've been given, and that's the best we can do that I'll do. I think going forward, like I said, we are going to be completely open about what our mission is here to make Charlotte more business and family friendly, and to some extent, everybody still will see. You have to have a disclosure of who pays for what ad, if it's a mail piece or a TV ad. You will see what group is putting that message out there. So, to some extent, people will become familiar with these groups, especially for Charlotte in the coming weeks, and we're not going to hide from what our mission is.
So let's talk tactics. What are you hoping to do here in the early days of the mayoral race?
Well, that's a good question. We're going to try and help drive a message that we feel is important. Understanding the last year and a half, there's been a whole lot of political infighting that isn't what Charlotte used to be about. We want to direct this message towards solutions and pro-business policy, reduce the crime rate, make this a better place to raise a family. Look at long-term solutions, refocus priorities in city government. Instead of spending over $500 million on a streetcar, maybe focus more on how we can come out of the bottom of the barrel in economic mobility, and talk about maybe facade grants, encourage new businesses and current businesses to stay here, and more business recruitment. That is our focus right now.
And that's a lot of messages. I understand the messaging is key, especially when it comes to political campaigns. But there is an inherent advantage that a 501c4 or other groups can have at a moment like this, which is you can already raise a lot more money than any or all of the candidates combined potentially. So are we talking television ads quickly before candidates can, get their own resources up? Are we talking direct mailers, calls? What do you see in the future?
We'll have to see how everything plays out. And again, we're more on the issue advocacy side of this, less so than directly influencing an election. And that's why also, next year we plan to be around doing the same thing to push our message and provide that voice for the business community. So, it's a little bit of a wait and see to see how things shake out. But we will be on TV and we'll be in all mediums contacting voters.
Okay. Larry, this is something that we've seen. This story has already played out in other cities, other major cities, Boston, Chicago, and Philly. What did we see there?
Well, we saw, and we're still seeing, groups coming in, these 501c4 groups coming in, spending a lot of money in these races, people not knowing where the money's coming from. Sometimes you hear stories or some information that gets out about the money. And we're also seeing, and we're working on this with various localities, efforts to try to reform the laws to get at where the money is actually coming from. So the problem is growing. It's not going to go away because it is very, because these groups are very effective. And, you know, and I appreciate what Mark said. And, you know, and the idea of having an agenda, wanting to get your issues out there, discuss them, you know, I understand what that's all about. But one of the things he said is we want to do this. And the big question is, who's the we? And that's what's happening in all these other cities. People want to now know who is the we that's coming in and spending millions of dollars to try to get us to vote a certain way. We can better judge the issue if we know who the we are. And that's what the problem is. It's going to keep growing. But I can tell you already there have been ballot measures in certain places to get fuller disclosure. We're working on ideas to get fuller disclosure to ensure that we actually find out who the donors are. And that, I think, is going to be the next battlefront in terms of legislation, ballot measures, that type of thing.
Do we know if the dark money groups in other cities have been effective in getting their candidate elected?
Some have, some haven't. I mean, there have been examples where they've spent a lot of money and they haven't been effective. And then there have been examples where they have been very effective. And you, and some people will debate how effective they actually are. I think there is no doubt that they are effective. They may not be able to buy the election. They may not be able to actually, at the end of the day, take a bad candidate and turn them into a good candidate. They may run up against a lot of money being spent on the other side. So there, it, you know, people always like to point out ones where a lot of money was spent by a C4 organization, and they weren't successful at it. But there are a lot of
Larry Noble is joining us by Skype. And Larry, are you back? All right, we'll try to restore that connection.
Can you hear me?
Are you there? Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say the other thing they do besides influencing, or besides necessarily being able to determine who wins or influence who wins directly, is they distort the field. They sometimes keep candidates in who the voters otherwise would not keep in a race. They sometimes force candidates to take certain positions. Whether the candidate wins or not, they determine the issues that are being debated. So they have an effect often that goes beyond just whether their candidate wins a particular race.
Mark, is that a fair critique?
Absolutely, I think so. I would also add, though, that I think that democracy works best when you hear all points of view, and we're going to provide some points of view.
Sure. You, of course, I believe campaign manager for Edwin Peacock last mayoral election, ran as a moderate. And I'm just curious, if you step back from your current role and go back to just being campaign manager, how would you feel if a group, an outside money group from the other side, started running ads or sending out flyers against your candidate?
Well, again, just to reiterate, I think democracy works best when you hear all points of view and voters have an opportunity to hear it all. But if I were in those shoes, and technically I was, I mean, HRC came in and they will claim that they spent...
a human rights campaign.
Correct. That they spent tens of thousands of dollars, if not more, pushing a handful of candidates. So that technically did happen, but... coming from the campaign's perspective, we would stay on message and stay focused on highlighting why Edwin Peacock was the right guy for the job. Typically, you see failing campaigns are the ones that will continuously point out and be obsessed with what the other side is saying about them rather than actually delivering their message.
Okay. So, Larry, I know you keep an overall eye on 501c4 groups. We mentioned Citizens United when I started off this segment. That, of course, is the landmark 2010 Supreme Court case that allowed – it basically gave corporations the same free speech rights in politics as individuals. Some would argue even more rights or more abilities. Since that point, do we have an idea of how 501c4 organizations have proliferated?
I don't have the figures in front of me, but they have proliferated, and we see a lot more of them. And what's interesting about it is that the C4 organizations have been around for a long time. And Mark talks about doing also issue ads. And they've traditionally done issue ads where, as one judge once said, yeah, it's an issue ad where the issue is who should be elected, where they clearly are very targeted issue ads. But what happened, and they were able to do this even before Citizens United, because they would claim they were not expressly advocating for a specific candidate. What happened with Citizens United is it not only freed corporations from making direct independent expenditures, advocating for candidates, but it gave, I think, a certain permission to corporations to work with the C4s, to spend more time with the C4s, to give them more money. I think they were less afraid after Citizens United about the gray areas here. So we saw a great increase in the C4 organizations. Now, I have to tell you, I was in private practice for a while, and I did this, represented some big companies. And one of the first questions you'd get when they were giving to a C4 is they'd ask us, well, will we be disclosed? And, you know, if we thought there was any danger they would be disclosed, they would say, you know, we don't want to do it then. And these are big corporations. We don't want to give. And so I understand where Mark is coming from in this. I didn't think it was right then. I don't think it's right now. I think if you're going to give to these organizations, that you should be disclosed. But the C4s are growing dramatically. You have the 527 organization, which is a super PAC. You can give to a super PAC, but your name is going to be disclosed. So the C4s are a way to avoid the name being disclosed. But the other thing that's going on is that super PACs are taking out a lot of these ads. If you look at who's giving to the super PAC, you can go on the records of either the federal records or state or local records and see. And what you see is the name of these organizations, these C4 organizations. So the C4 organizations aren't just taking out the ads themselves. They're giving to super PACs. Super PACs take out the ads, and we lose the disclosure of the super PACs.
It's
so
a
instead
bit of
the
shell game.
It's a shell game. And what we're seeing is transfers. They're transferring money from one C4 to another C4 that then gives to a super PAC. So it is a shell game.
I want to go to a question that we received from Dylan on Facebook, who writes, organizations like Sierra Club, NAACP, and Planned Parenthood are all 501c4 groups. Why are we not talking about them in the same way?
We are. You know, my view of it is, if they're doing the same thing, and some of them are, then we have the same problem with them. Now, some of these groups have political action committees, which do report their donors, and you know, and that is in full compliance with the concept of disclosure. But this is not a Republican-Democratic issue as far as I'm concerned. I mean, we've criticized Democratic groups that have done the same thing. They exist on both sides. It doesn't make it right. You know, and I'm also more concerned, I have to tell you, about groups that take large donations as opposed to the ones that take very small donations. So in some of the proposals we've seen for disclosure, keep the threshold at a relatively high level if it's truly independent of a candidate, so that you don't get the $50 or the $100 donor. That's not the real concern. But what we want to know is who's the $100,000 donor, $10,000 donor. And it's true on the Republican side and on the Democratic side. This is not a partisan issue.
Now, Mark, you have said that this upcoming race for, again, a mayor who is symbolic, has influence but no real power, is probably going to shatter spending records. And I think that the last spending record was around $1 million. Why do you think it's going to just, you know, this year is going to blow those years out of the water?
Well, I think in the last year and a half, everybody has seen what the mayor can actually accomplish in a not so good way. I don't think people are happy about the direction in Charlotte. I think that's also evidenced by Jennifer Roberts' own poll that she put out in a statement showing her at 35% in a Democrat primary. So her home base.
And in fairness, that's against three other known candidates. So it's not
right.
It's not against it.
An incumbent mayor, you know, patting herself on the back for 35% of her home base is not a good thing.
That's fair enough. All right. I want to say thank you to Mark Knoop, is the Republican strategist and executive director of Forward Charlotte, and Larry Noble, senior director, ethics and general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center. He joined us via Skype. Thank you both for stopping in. Next, we go from dark money to Broadway. You're listening to Charlotte Talks.
We'll get back to more Charlotte Talks in a moment. This is listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Veritas Collaborative, offering a continuing education series for healthcare professionals focused on children, adolescents, and adults with eating disorders, Friday, June 30th. Information at veritascollaborative.com/events. And from Charlotte Douglas International Airport, during the summer, the long-term economy parking fills up fast at CLT Airport. Parking alternatives and travel tips are available at cltairport.com. Coming up in 20 minutes, it's On Point with Tom Ashbrook. What's in your credit score? Millions will get a bump next month. We'll look at why and at Google's antitrust troubles in Europe. On Point starts at 10 o'clock on 90.7 WFAE.
Your days move fast. So does the news.
On the London Bridge, a van just plowed into...
The United States will withdraw.
These Russian cyber hackers
said... I didn't walk into Charlotte School of Law thinking it was Yale.
Spend 20 minutes with NPR News to get ready for the day with the latest news with context and perspective. You'll leave home with a clearer picture of the world. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Tom Bullock. If you're a fan of Broadway, you've likely heard of the musical Fun Home. And even if you're not, you're going to want to hear this next segment. Fun Home has won Tonys and rave reviews, frankly, way too many to mention here, but here's a taste. The New York Times called it extraordinary, a rare beauty that pumps fresh air into Broadway. Fun Home just opened at the Knight Theater last night. You can find more information on performances on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Barbara Whitman produces the show and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Now, Barbara, your resume is impressive, to say the least. Multiple Tony Awards. Frankly, you would normally get top billing in probably any interview because of your career so far. But that's not quite the case today, because Fun Home is the homecoming of a Charlottean. Hi there.
Hi.
So tell us your name, age, and when you graduated from high school.
My name is Abby Corrigan. I am 19 years old, and I graduated from Northwest School of the Arts last year.
Yeah, just about this time last year. So you're supposed to be basically a freshman in college. You were supposed to take off to go do college. Instead, you're opening a Broadway tour in your hometown. You opened it last night. What was that like?
That was pretty cool. I think because, you know, I was always the one at the stage door. Like, I come to see all the tours that come through here, and I was always the one going up to the people to ask them for their autographs and having, like, doing the same thing here, but I'm coming out of the stage door instead is pretty wild.
And you're getting autograph requests and everything?
Yes.
That's got to be crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
All right. Well, we're going to tell your story. I mean, that's just kind of a taste of the story. But before we go any farther on that, Barbara, I haven't, as I just said to you before during the break, I haven't had a chance to see the show yet. My wife and I are going on Saturday. But I've read a lot about it. And it's a fascinating, fascinating musical. Explain for us, Barbara, because you were there from the beginning, the premise of Fun Home.
Well, it's based on a graphic novel by Alison Bechtel, and she wrote a true story of her rather unusual family circumstance. Fun Home is what they called their house. They lived in a funeral home, and they called it the Fun Home. And so Alison, when she wrote this graphic novel, she was looking back on her life growing up in the Fun Home, going to college, figuring out who she was and her place in the world, and the rather unusual family in that she ended up in college coming out as a lesbian. She told her parents, and shortly after that, she found out her father was in the closet, and he committed suicide. So, which is really, you know, as everyone says, you know, exactly what you think a Broadway musical would be about. But what we love about this show so much is it's about a very specific family, but it really is about every family, because everyone has been a kid trying to figure out their parents' relationship, and everyone has been an adult trying to figure out what they want to do when they grow up.
Sure.
So it's very universal in its specificity.
And it's also, I mean, it's incredibly poignant. It's funny.
It's funny.
It's, I mean, it's
kinda real and it's heartfelt.
Yeah.
It's just a lovely, lovely, lovely show.
I have to say, again, that's why I'm so excited to see it, because everything I've read just points to these moments in the show that are just, I'm going to try not to do any spoilers here, but Abby, you play medium Allison, and it's important to note that this story is really broken into three parts. You have, you know, three different versions of the title character. Tell us who medium Allison is and how she fits into the plot.
Well, it's Allison at 19, and you see at the beginning of the show when she is going to college, and at this point in her life is when she kind of discovers her own sexuality and is coming to terms with who she is, and also she finds out that her father was a closeted homosexual. Mm-hmm. At this time, and it is, you know, it's
Every single time I come out on stage, it's like one of the most important moments in Allison's life. So it's very – there's no like coffee shop scene. You know, it's all very important.
Yeah. And – but again, funny.
Very funny.
And
yes.
I think – and I think – well, we have a bit of this actually. It's a song that kind of encapsulates where you are. And this is you singing as Medium Allison. The song is called Changing My Major to Joan. And we're going to – now, in fairness, there are only certain parts of the song that we can play on the radio, but we found them. But set us up. What is – you know, right before you launch into the song, set us on – put this on stage with you. What is the song about?
So, the song is really – I mean, if you've ever kind of fallen in lust or in love with someone, this is how it feels after you have – done the deed with them for the first time, I guess, is kind of like what this song is about. And it's about absolute joy and being afraid of the future, but also just being so happy that, you know, because once you have released something that you've been holding in your whole life, you know, it's like the most fantastic feeling. And it's all over the place, but it's also extremely organized in the way that she's, you know, trying to find her way.
Indeed. And let's take a listen now to Abby Corrigan singing Changing My Major to Joan from Fun Home.
I don't know who I am. I've become someone new. Nothing I just did is anything I would do. Overnight, everything changed. I am not prepared. I'm dizzy, I'm nauseous, I'm shaky. I'm scared. Am I falling into nothingness or flying into something so sublime? I don't know, but I'm changing my major to Joan. I thought all my life I'd be
so clearly
alone.
You've got some singing chops there, to say the least. But, you know, one of the things that really wows me about that song, it's the angst. It's the questioning. It's just the right pitch change, the little uptone that is very symbolic of how people talk when they're very confused. Capturing that in song is not easy.
That's all Janine Tesori.
All right, explain to everyone who Janine Tesori is.
Janine Tesori is a Tony Award-winning composer, and she's fantastic. Also Lisa Krohn, who wrote the book, and I believe she worked on lyrics as well.
She wrote the lyrics, and they're the first women composing team to win Tony Awards for their work. And they're both brilliant.
And it's not easy. I mean, again,
and it's not easy
this,
what they do. Yeah.
Writing songs, period, is difficult. Mm-hmm. But trying to convert a graphic novel, which is not normally known for, you know, inspiring music, into just the right tone at just the right moment. I mean, what was it like for them to write these songs? You were right there with them, I take it.
I came on after most of it had been written.
Sure.
But they're so smart. They're so insightful. They really knew, they knew how to take that book, and I don't know how they did it. The elements that made the story that you needed and leave a lot of the other elements out. And they also added things in that weren't in the book. And, you know, for example, there's a number where the kids are playing in the caskets. I mean, I guess I could say that. Spoiler
yes.
alert. that's a whole song that wasn't in the book, but somehow, it was the exact right way to capture the way they're growing up in the funeral home.
And I'm assuming they worked directly with Allison, the writer.
Allison, you know, gave them the rights, and they worked with her for her memories. But Allison had a very hands-off approach to creating the musical because she said she doesn't know how to do musicals. What I love about Allison is she'd been approached to make it a movie, and she was afraid. She always said no. But when she got asked if they could make a musical, she said sure, because she figured if it was terrible, it would disappear and no one would ever see it. And she is incredibly proud and a wonderful supporter of our show. But she really had a hands-off approach and let Janine and Lisa do it.
And, I mean, she wasn't all that wrong. I mean, this is – bad musicals can go away. Movies, of course, are printed forever, or you can always find them on Netflix. But this musical itself, you know, it is a Broadway smash. It is multiple Tony Award. I think two Tony Awards.
Five.
Oh, wow. I need to work on my math. I apologize. Regardless, it is... It did not take the typical path to Broadway. So walk us through that.
Well, we did it first at the Public Theater. I was involved with it, but it was their production. We did several different productions there and several different readings. And we knew that it would have to hit like a giant explosion in order for us to move it to a commercial theater. And it did. We were so fortunate. You know, the production was beautiful. Our director, Sam Gold, is also a brilliant, brilliant man. And they just created this really special show that audiences respond to organically. And because of the response, we then knew we could move it to Broadway, although people thought we were a little crazy. And they kept saying, you're moving that show to Broadway? Because it's so unusual and human. And usually Broadway, you know, Broadway tends to be big spectacles. And this is a very different experience.
And very not Disney. Where
and
Disney
very not, right.
Kind of leading the way with a lot of musicals.
Right. And we don't have tap dance numbers. We're very different. We're very much our own thing. But what's been great about it all along, both on Broadway and on tour, audiences have responded to it with open arms, and they love it. I mean, Abby can address that, the reaction she's gotten around the country.
It's been very eclectic, I think, all the different kinds of reactions we've gotten, because, I mean, but for the most part, it's people will come up to you and say, like, that is exactly my family and not at all, but I totally understand what that is. Like, and people have come up to me, but my father was a closeted homosexual and he killed himself. Hmm. Or like, people come up to me all the time and are like, that was me. Like, in changing my major, like, I know what that feels like. And I'm always like, you'd be surprised how many people say that, because it's, I mean, everybody, I always say this, like, everybody, we all grow up in different ways, but everybody feels things.
Sure.
You know, everybody feels the same things and everybody has had a family.
Sure, and complications with that family, that moment when you discover the parent is something that you didn't think they were, whether it's sexuality or, you know, they have a flaw, whatever it is.
When you see them as another person rather than as your mom or dad.
Totally.
And when you get in your own relationships and you look back and say, oh, my parents were doing that. I mean, when you're a kid, you're not looking at how your parents are learning to partner and be a couple. But when you look back on them, I mean, who wouldn't want the opportunity to look back and say, oh, that was what was going on. I had no idea. Or, look, you know, big Allison, because we have a small Allison as a child, medium Allison, who Abby plays, and we have big Allison, who's looking back. And she goes back in her memories and looks back and sees what she was doing as her younger self. And, I mean, it's really fun to watch herself.
Yeah.
And to see what it was like to from an adult perspective, to watch yourself in college or watch yourself in when you were a little kid.
Yeah, she was saying the other day, she just, at the finale, you know, because, like, I won't say, but, like, looking back at yourself is so powerful, she said, for her, to imagine her other selves looking back and, like, almost imparting words to her that, like, she may have forgotten is such a powerful thing.
Now, your character, again, Medium Allison, is 19.
Yes.
And so are you.
Yes.
which it sounds convenient, but that's actually pretty rare for, you know, a top-shelf touring company of a Broadway hit. I'm curious what it was like to audition for this.
It was pretty... amazing. I think I was at Unified's auditioning
and that's
for college.
A big thing where high school students can go through, or college younger actors and actresses can go through an audition in front of a bunch of...
Yeah, all the colleges come to one spot,
yeah.
So you don't have to fly everywhere. And I was there auditioning, and Michael Rafter, who runs a camp in New York called Destination Broadway, called me up on, like, the Thursday of the week and was like, hey, wake up. I got you this audition, memorize this song and these three scenes and go. And at, like, 3 hours later, I went in and I auditioned for Jillian, who's a casting director. It was just her. And then she called me back and she gave me tickets to see the show. And I saw the show and I was like, oh my gosh, I just want to eat this up in my mouth. Because it's like it's really spectacular. And then I had two callbacks after that with a lot of producers.
And you're pointing to Barbara.
And, yes, Barbara here. And
I'm going to say, I'll step in for a second. When Abby came in, there was no question in our mind we were going to cast her. She was Medium Alice, and we loved her. Really? It was one of the best auditions we'd ever seen. But then we said to her, just have to say this, we said, oh, what are you doing? She said, oh, I'm graduating in a couple weeks. And we said, oh, what college? And she said, no, high school. We were like, oh, okay. We had no idea. She presented herself as a seasoned professional.
And the reason I was interrupting, I'm glad you brought up that point, is I have to believe for this kind of role in this kind of show at this time, the competition was, I mean, I'm sure there were a ton of absolutely great actresses trying out for this role.
Yes.
So what was it? What made Abby stand out?
She just blew everyone out of the water. Every scene she did, I can't even say what it was. But when you see two people performing a scene and you can't take your eyes off one, and in the other one you just don't even notice. And that's we paired her up with a bunch of different people. Didn't you read it with a couple of different times?
I did. I think, yeah.
And no matter who she was with, we could never stop watching her.
And she was a high school student, still a high school student.
Mm-hmm.
Were there concerns about that? I mean, you're talking about a major tour for someone who, certainly has not spent that amount of time away from home.
Well, no. I mean, we just trusted that she was such a seasoned professional, and she was 18, so.
Good to go.
Sam asked, he was like, are you 18? And I was like, yeah.
Because that actually would impact on us, because we have to tutor. We carry a lot of children in our company, and we have a teacher that goes on the tour with us. And the parents. It's a little more complicated when you have someone who's underage.
So I'm disappointed in what I'm about to say. We've only got about a minute left, or a couple seconds left. I wanted to play a bit of you as Fiona from Shrek, because, of course, all that long ago, you were right here doing the Bloomies. As best actress for the Bloomies, I believe, in 2014, and now you're back on tour. But you're safe from that, because unfortunately we are out of time. I want to thank our two guests for this final part of the show, Barbara Whitman, producer for Fun Home, and Abby Corrigan, who currently stars as Medium Allison. Thank you both. You can find details about the show on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. It's at the Knight Theater for
the rest of this week.
There we go. So make sure you see it. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.